So this is Anina Livingstone, and we're here with Frances Weller. We're going to talk about soul activism today. And just to introduce Frances, he's a MFT psychotherapist, writer, and soul activist. He's a master of synthesizing diverse streams of thought from psychology, anthropology, mythology, alchemy, indigenous cultures, and poetic traditions. He's the author of The Wild Edge of Sorrow, Rituals of Renewal, and The Sacred Work of Grief. And he's introduced the healing work of ritual to thousands of people. The core of his work is creating pathways to reclaiming our indigenous soul, which psychologist Carl Jung called the unforgotten wisdom that resides in the heart of the psyche. To further this work, he founded and directs Wisdom Bridge, an organization that offers educational programs that seek to integrate the wisdom from traditional cultures with the insights and knowledge gathered from Western cultures. So welcome, Frances.
Thank you, Anina. It's always good to be with you.
Good. I feel the same. So I'm really excited about being able to speak with you, who I learned this term myself, soul activism, from you. I'm not sure if you coined it, but I'd love to start with just what your relationship with that term is, soul activism, and how you started to connect with that or created it. I'm not quite sure.
I'm not sure if we coined the term or not, but we've been using it for a long time to speak to a quality of response to circumstance in the culture in our community that isn't so much focused on like sociological or psychological responses, but coming from a more soul-based or archetypal-based response, which is focused more on aesthetics, more on ritual, more on a deep sense of connection to the natural world, and how those all coalesce and intermingle with one another. It also speaks to the threads that run through an ancestral lineage. In other words, it has more of a mythic base than a psychological base as a foundation for response, for reply to the call that's coming from whatever circumstances we're facing.
Mm-hmm. So I understand what you're saying, and I'm wondering if you were to say that in a way that was, like, if you had to give a definition that was kind of simple for someone who not necessarily steeped in all these kind of different realms that you're steeped in, because it feels like I can't let that land fully in a simple way, even though I understand it. And I'm wondering, you know what I'm saying? Like, what would your definition of soul activism be if someone just said, okay, what is that? Someone who's never heard of all these different ways of being in the world, aesthetics, ritual, nature, ancestral lineage, that's not familiar to everybody.
No, it's not. And yet it is.
I mean, yes.
It is what I would call the commons of the soul.
Okay.
At the deep base of the soul life, these are the things that actually hold meaning and hold value. So my simplest definition of soul activism would be a return to the commons of what it is we share as human beings. We all know grief. We all know loss. We all hopefully have some encounter with love and friendship. Mm-hmm. We all wrestle with our longings to belong. And soul activism attempts to try to respond to those core central issues with means that actually help to address them, like ritual.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the means by which we try to address those core human needs.
Right.
A little clear?
That is clear, and I'm just going to name here, which I shared with you before we got on, that I'm in a place of some grief myself with my mother aging, and so that may kind of inform where I'm coming from right now. I'm a little heavy-hearted, so I'm going to do my best to kind of also engage these ideas. But maybe since that's what's present, if you could just say a little bit more about the relationship with grief and soul activism. There's a lot that we're grieving communally, as there has been for quite some time, but obviously it's, you know, intensified lately. And then we have our personal grief. Can you say more about soul activism and grief?
Well, I think the reality is that every one of us will know loss in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And what we are culturally confined to in terms of responding to that grief is a very private, kind of interiorized experience.
Mm-hmm.
We've privatized grief. It's something I deal with alone. Maybe I'll talk to a therapist about it. But the larger context, I would say the original context for grief and loss was communal. And the original modalities for responding to it were done through communal ritual. So what I hear over and over again in my work with people, both in my practice but also the grief rituals we do, is that we are longing for some permission to have a way of expressing our grief that isn't quite so contained and quite so solitary.
Mm-hmm.
We need community around this. I mean, especially in times of acute grief, much less the chronic grief that we're all carrying right now for the world, for our environmental circumstances, for what's going on culturally. This is too much for us to carry as individuals, or even in just a singular presence of a therapist. We really do require a return to the original context, what I call the primal matrix for that work, which is community.
Yeah. So
and
I
hear the
really,
heaviness.
Yeah. Pardon?
And I hear the heaviness in your voice.
Yeah, and so I'm just going to be here in the most transparent way I can, because it won't work any other way. And so being in a place of heavy-heartedness, I'm noticing that, you know, in how your mind is not working in the same way when your heart is really heavy. So these are all landing in a very conceptual way at the moment. But what I've learned about also the way soul works in a collective way is to trust everything that's here and trust that it can serve whatever is here. So I'm just doing that by including this. And I'm going to just speak with you less out of kind of a interviewer and just a really much more personal place.
Uh-huh.
And so I think what I want to bring a little bit is my own struggle with the word activism, and just see what you might have to say about that, which is, you know, so when you talk about all this and I'm not able to take it in the way I normally can, I notice this split between the mind and just this kind of very simple instinctual place of the struggle that I've been having, which is there's so much that's demanding our attention, and it seems to be, so for example, you know, calling our representatives, getting out in the street, taking action that's based on a sense of urgency for the things that are being threatened right now by this presidential, you know, the president we have and the cabinet that we have, et cetera. And so when you talk about things that have to do more with the quality of our response, this part that is learning to make peace with the fact that I'm guided to soul activism and not highly strategic, quick responses, that's been my challenge. How do you bridge or make peace with the fact that so much is being required from such an urgent place, and that yet the soul is a slow-moving thing of much different. I mean, sometimes the soul moves quickly, but mine has not been moving quickly in response to what's happening. So I guess I'm just asking, how do you hold this urgency and then the soul, which can move slowly at times, to even know how we are going to respond from a deep place? There's a lot of listening that needs to happen, and sometimes that's slow.
Well, we have to have some capacity to hold the various rhythms that soul responds to the circumstances we face, we somehow mistakenly equate intensity for effectiveness. Mm-hmm. And we're addicted to intensity in this culture, even psychologically. We think that if it wasn't intense, it had no meaning or had no effect. And so activism kind of gets lumped in with intensity. And I'm not sure that's always the correct equation. I mean, there's a very effective activism in silence and, in kindness. So I think we need a multiplicity of ways of responding to the circumstances we're facing, not just the single one that's rooted in some type of urgent activism. And we need that, obviously, but there's many other ways that we can respond, and it has to be native to our own character, to our own style. And my work is in these gatherings of 25 to 30, sometimes larger circles, in giving people an opportunity to weep together. Now, does that make a change in the culture? I think it does. I think it does by the very fact that what happens in the course of those times together is that the heart becomes more spacious and more capable of responding to the world with compassion and with effectiveness, rather than being clouded and congested with all of the undigested pieces of grief that we're carrying around. So it may not look like it has a direct effect on the circumstances with our administration, but what it does is it affects the quality of what's happening in our streets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I deeply resonate with that, and that is native to me, and I think that's partly why I struggle, because I see a lot of other types of activism that I feel like I should be engaging in, and I'm not feeling an organic pull to do that. And so that's partly why I'm offering this day-long on soul activism, because out of my own question of what can I offer that is native to me, that's what I can offer, a sacred space to explore this. Mm-hmm. But the questions do arise for me of, if I'm not drawn to you speak a lot about culture, and that's also a place I feel drawn to, kind of being the alchemical agent culturally. But then there's this whole question of structural change, or at least slowing down things that could be damaging to the structures we have in place. And so I guess it comes down to, the question of the critic, which I know you call the predator, and maybe you can speak to that in terms of, what if our organic impulses don't include calling representatives? That brings up issues of conscience for me as well as critics. So I'd love if you could speak to that.
Well, I'm reminded of a phrase by Wendell Berry, the farmer, poet. Mm-hmm. He said, it all turns on affection. Mm-hmm. And I think if we're doing it out of some moralistic basis, the shoulds, I don't know if that's going to be effective in the long run. I think we will save the planet or our community or our children or the next generations more out of a sense of affection, of what we love. And so I always come back to, what is it that activates the heart and keeps the heart leaning into the world rather than shuttering itself out of fear or anxiety or overwhelm? I have to participate in those things that keep the heart soft, that keep the heart responsive and reflective to the world and to the circumstances that the world is facing. So I haven't made one single call to a representative myself, but I feel like I've touched a lot of people in the past years that have allowed them maybe to make a phone call. That's not my style. I don't feel moved to do that. I feel very moved to sit with people and help move grief out of their bodies so that they are, again, like I said, more capable of responding to the world with affection, with care, with compassion. But when I use the word compassion, that doesn't mean something soft and nice. It means sometimes outrage is a form of compassion. It's a way of responding to the circumstances of injustice or violence or oppression and seeking justice. Love and power are very interesting dynamics in this situation. We need to have a working relationship with both of those energies. Jung once said, where love reigns, there the will to power is absent. And where power predominates, there love is lacking. The one is the shadow of the other. Now, what I think he's saying by that is that our work is to not choose either one of those poles. If we choose love, then our power goes into the shadow and we become passive-aggressive or manipulative or sarcastic. If we choose power, then our love goes into the shadow and we become absent and detached and cool and separated from the lifeblood of the world. But if we hold them in a dynamic tension between love and power, then we've got something vital and dynamic going on at the core of our being. Our love needs power in order to feel potent and vital. And our power needs love in order to feel concerned with justice issues and with issues of compassion. And so those things dynamically together, I think, give us a better sense of what shape my action will take in the world. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. And the places where I feel love and power have to do with race, and that feels, you know, facing issues of racism and injustice and, as you said, oppression. And then that's a place where love and power come together, and the question of conscience and the critic doesn't even arise because it's so organic and so filled with love and passion. So I know that on a visceral level. And that's always been a place where I could rest. And then with the increased intensity of what's going on politically right now, suddenly questions of conscience and the critic became very, very loud, and these questions got stronger of, well, is this enough to just follow the place of organic arising, you know? But I appreciate, you know, you bringing it back to soul, and I wonder if there's, you know, when you speak of oppression, I often think about issues of privilege, and one of the things that my critic has said, but also, you know, maybe it's a question I hold, is how does my privilege impact the choices I make? And if I'm just allowing myself to follow my organic arising, there's this question, is that part of privilege? I don't know if that makes sense, but let me know.
Excuse me, it does. I think we have a tremendous responsibility to not privatize that experience of soul either. That there is a phrase from the alchemist Sandivogius, he said, the greater part of the soul lies outside the body. So in other words, my experience of soul is also communal as well as it is private. It's interior and exterior. It's introverted and extroverted. So for me to pay attention to soul, it's also a pull on a very deep level to participate in the mending and repair of culture, whether that's through race issues or economic issues or homelessness or whatever those issues are, they're not separate from me. And the deeper we go into heart and soul through our communal work, our ritual work, our prayer work, whatever it is we're doing, we recognize that. There is no place that is not impacting us in a very, very profound and deep way. So, yes, all of these things, whichever ones kind of come into our circulation, we're in a sense obligated to respond to it in some fashion, in some way.
Yeah, so I'm sitting with that. We're obligated to respond, whatever comes into our circulation. So, you know, as someone with, you know, European ancestry, race doesn't necessarily, in the community I live in, race issues don't necessarily come too close unless it's through the news. And I think there's a lot of ways that things don't have to come close if we don't want them to, right? This idea of, like, proximity of suffering, I think that's Stevenson. Like, there's this way that we can easily not let things come close, and then we won't feel the obligation to respond because it's, you know, we can easily kind of remain in our smaller circle of influence and experience. And that's, again, where, for me, the question of where's the responsibility lie and issues of privilege, being able to be kind of insulated. It also starts to go into a larger question for me of where we're numb, where we're dissociated, where we're cut off, where it's hard to access the impulse because we can't even feel it, or we don't see it, or we're not connected to it.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
There's no doubt that these are incredibly complex territories.
Uh-huh.
And I think what we can do is keep thinning the distance between us and what's happening in the world. This isn't about withdrawal or retreat.
Right.
That's one of the reasons why we use the term activism.
Mm-hmm.
It's allowing a deeper sensitivity to arise through the communal work that we do to the larger questions that are being asked. I can tell you for sure that over the past, I would say, 10 years of doing the grief work, we have seen more and more people coming to these gatherings, not because of personal losses, but because of what's happening in the culture.
Mm-hmm.
They're speaking to this communal, ancestral grief that's there. And sometimes it's upwards of 50% of the people in the room saying, I'm here because of what's happening in our culture. I'm here because of ancestral grief. They're here to address those background issues that we rarely get to because we are preoccupied with personal circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, where some of the deeper healing has to occur.
Right. And it is pushing more and more on all of us. It's harder and harder to ignore.
Absolutely. The levels of denial are really being shattered, which to me, ironically, I think that our greatest hope lies in the broken heart.
Mm-hmm.
There is a possibility that it'll be through grief and through sorrow that we will fall in love with this world again.
Mm-hmm.
And that we will fall in love with life again. And we will advocate and protect and attempt to give voice to the voiceless and to speak for what needs to be spoken. But it will come through the broken heart. That's my hope.
Yeah. I'm with you. I have hope through that as well. I mean, that's part of what I'm hoping to offer myself, is just a place where people can step outside of our busy lives and actually feel, because it's in the feeling that we can access. If there is an impulse to act, we have to go through the feelings first.
Right. Right, again, through the heart, through the goal of the heart.
Mm.
You know, it has to move through that central point of receptivity to the world, and slowing down is one of the primary practices. I mean, again, activism has a sense of action attached to it, but there really is a place for slowing down in order to really hear and receive a more intimate thread of what's there. In the Chinese language, they spell the word busy with two ideograms that stand for heart and killing.
Oh, my.
So busyness is heart killing.
Hmm.
So we have to be very mindful of coming back into what my mentor, Clark Berry, called a geologic speed. Coming back into a speed that's very much akin to the soul, how it moved through the world for the first several hundred thousand years, or over a million years, was at that pace that was akin to birdsong and to rainfall and to creeks and to walking, and slowing us down so we can actually come back into some place of receptivity and hearing and listening. It's hard to do that at 70 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's a paradox. I mean, activism...
It is a paradox.
That's why
I'm glad
the soul
you said that word.
Yeah. That's why I like the combination of soul and activism together, because they ask us to not be uniform or... that's the word, one-dimensional in our response, but to hold complexity and contradiction simultaneously, to pause and reflect and to act. These things don't necessarily go together in our minds, but at a deeper layer, they make perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
There's a phrase in Africa, we must hasten slowly.
Mm-hmm.
That we, yes, we want to act, but we have to do that in a way that doesn't lose contact with our humanness or with soul. That's got to be the basis out of which we respond.
Right. That word paradox, just something clicked when you said that, because I think that's part of the question I'm holding around soul activism, is what apparently looks contradictory with this urgency and yet with the deep knowing that the only way I have found to respond is through the soul, and so kind of sitting with these strange tensions. So it's really wonderful to hear you put that in words.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I work with a lot of activists in the grief rituals, and they're burned out.
Mm-hmm.
They're overwhelmed. I mean, even the idea of burnout, it means too much fire and not enough water, not enough earth. We need those other elements, too, to slow it down, to come back into the states of sharing grief together. But we need these activists, we need all of us, to have enough basis in that root rhythm so we don't burn out, so that we can continue to show up for the next generation and for the... you know, for the salmon and for everything else that needs protection and our affection, but to come at it from a place that has a touch into that deeper resonating field of soul, I think is vital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks like you're offering more and more of those circles from what I could tell on the website. More grief.
Well, there's a lot of them this year.
Yeah,
the demand just keeps increasing, and you know, what I'm going to do is to train people how to do this, because I can't meet all the expectations.
Wow. Well, let's talk after this call. That's important. So once we do slow down, and once we are able to access the receptivity of the heart, as you're mentioning, then there's this kind of discerning process of where am I going to put my energy? And we're all touched by different things. We all have different sensitivities and different gifts. And my experience so far of soul activism is I really don't see much difference between that and calling in terms of the experience of it, only in the intention that it's moving specifically towards holding the reality of the world, although for me, calling has always done that as well. But soul activism kind of puts that in a much more intentional kind of focus. And so I'm wondering if you distinguish calling from soul activism at all, and if so, how?
I'm sure they overlap quite a bit. And I would imagine that a calling or a purpose is part of how you... It's particular to the style or to the thing that you're called to express as soul activism. Like for me, my wounds, my gift, brings me into the territory of grief and shame and loss. So I cannot not do that. It's part of where I'm called to be. It's the territory that's most alluring from soul, at a soul level. And then how to express that is my activism. I could sit in my room and just do one-on-one sessions. Yeah, I could. But I had a larger feeling of needing to find ways to make this more communal. And that's the activism piece of it. It circulates around my... Well, there's an old Greek phrase, in your wound is your genius. Mm-hmm. That the very places that we are afflicted are the places that we have the greatest sensitivity and the greatest, in the long term, and the greatest capacity to respond medicinally or curatively to the culture. So my wounds around shame and questions of worth and adequacy, of belonging, all became part of what, over time, were articulated into a particular style of medicine in the world. And that's what I've done. I can't get away from it. It's, mm-hmm. My definition of purpose is the thing you cannot get away from. It keeps calling me back to it. And so... And then the activism is kind of the communal cultural expression of how that's going to be given shape in the world. And mm-hmm. So I'm doing the grief rituals, the gratitude rituals, I did the men's initiation work. All these things are forms of activism that arise out of my particular experience of both wound and gift.
Right. Just sitting with that for a moment in terms of kind of where one ends and one begins, there's not quite much of a distinction. Oh. The bringing it communally, is that also something you felt you couldn't get away from, or is that more a choice that I'm actually going to choose to bring this communally because that's my choice of activism in the world?
Well, I'll just tell you a quick story. Many years ago, I had an encounter with a healer, and she took me out into the woods and had me do this imaginal experience of going back 20,000 generations and asking the old ones what I needed for healing. And I had no idea how to do this, but she sang and rattled. I kind of sunk into the forest floor and had this image of these beings walking towards me, and they said to me, you must gather together all that has been made not sacred. That was their injunction to me. And all of these thoughts came to my mind, all the parts of my life that were made not sacred. And so I did a very personal ritual for that, and felt like I had listened and followed the instructions. But about 6 months or a year later, a dream came, and the voice in the dream said, that was not meant for you alone. Is the work of the people that you must all gather together what has been made not sacred. And out of that came this beautiful reclaiming ritual that we do now every year. Where does one begin and where does the other pick up? I had to do my own reclaiming work. I had to make sacred parts of my own life, but I also get now that my wounds are not separate from the cultural wounds, that they are coextensive, they co-arise. I think one of the shadows of Western psychology is how much it interiorizes and privatizes our experience to the point where it makes us feel exceptional. Mm-hmm. My wounds make me exceptional, rather than if we could hold it more mythologically or from a soul perspective. My wounds actually bring me into the commons, that this is all shared. We all know this place. We all experience at least some variety of these things. Mm-hmm. So where does one begin, where does the other end or start? That's a pretty blurry line.
Right.
It is the work of all of our people. So my pull to be more communal with this has been, you know, something that has felt very organic and right and true, and I feel as if when I'm in that seat, I'm right where I need to be.
Right. Yeah, and you're trusting that on a very deep level. There's not a lot of static of, oh my God, I should be calling the representatives. I'm not doing my part.
No.
Yeah.
No. I feel very congruent with that, with what I am being asked to do.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's such an essential part of soul activism is that trust place. And I'm starting to also see that the lack of trust for me is part of the wound and the gift, because in not trusting it, it brings some very important questions to the surface that I think we share culturally at this time. And so I'm learning to like, okay, so this is a place of conflict for me, but I can share this conflict and make something of it as a gift, because there's so many of us wondering, what's enough? What should I do? Is it enough? What's my role here? How do I belong to this time?
Right.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, this conversation is soul activism. You're holding this program as soul activism.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't so much to have the answers or the right response, but it is really to enter into a deeper dialogue of how can I respond? I remember giving a talk up in Victoria, Canada, on grief work, and at some point a young woman said, so what is the answer to all of this stuff? And I said, there is no answer, but there is a response. And each of us must decipher that response that we can make, because if we are collectively making our responses, things can shift.
Right.
While we're trying to figure out the answer, I think it almost paralyzes us.
Mm-hmm.
But we can certainly respond. We can respond to what we see in the streets or in the restaurants or at home, and we can respond in ways that are effective and kind and potent and strong. But that's an ongoing attunement to circumstance and opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
We're being given them all the time.
Right. Yes. So easy to want an answer. So, you know, and have something concrete. What is soul activism? Make it more simple for me. I started
right.
there.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's where, I mean, I think what we're being asked is to live with more and more complexity. I think that is the side of maturation,
mm-hmm.
is to not rely upon single vision answers, but to live with the multiplicity of things and the complexity of things.
Yeah.
That's a much harder thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But we get into this fundamentalist thinking process of one way, then we're in trouble.
Yeah.
Even if we think we have the right way, we're in trouble.
Right. And I remember you saying once, you know, thank God for the people who, that is part of their soul activism, to get out on the streets, to do civil disobedience, to make those calls, that, you know, there are people for whom that is their soul activism, and we're all needed, and all those responses are needed.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
I'm deeply grateful. And, you know, I'm more introverted and more reflective in how my responses come out. But I'm not saying that's the right way either.
Yeah.
But it really is that deep attunement to how does the soul wish to express its own affection for the world in this moment. It might change. You know,
right.
It might change. I might do something very different. But
right
now this feels congruent and
mm-hmm.
and effective.
Yeah.
You're doing this congruent and effective.
Mm-hmm. So we just have a few more minutes. I wanted to end on the question of hope and the future. And, you know, what I noticed for myself is that I actually don't think about when I'm engaged in soul activism so much what the results will be. It feels like because it's so process oriented that I'm just in the process of it, offering it for its own sake, trusting the intelligence of whatever you might want to call that, greater intelligence. And wondering how you hold that in terms of the question of hope. Is your action connected to a desire for a certain outcome, or where are you in relation to that question?
I often ask myself, would it make any difference in what I'm doing if I had hope or didn't have hope?
Mm-hmm.
And the question is no. I don't know what's going to happen. Things look grim.
Yeah.
In many, many ways. But I'm open to surprise. I'm open to things not meeting my expectations. But it won't change how I'm showing up. And it won't change what I am trying to help create, which is more of a soulful culture. Hope is hope can actually, I think, at times I don't want to say this. It can actually find a way to blunt or dull our conviction. I'm not sure I'm saying that the way I want to say it, so I think what I'll end up saying is it doesn't affect how I am doing my work in the world at all. It's as if the question's above my pay grade, and I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen, so all I can do is trust how my soul is asking me to act in the world right now.
Mm-hmm.
And trust that. I have deep faith in that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Difficult question.
Pardon?
It's a difficult question.
Yeah, it's a difficult question. I like Joanna Macy's idea of active hope, that it's not necessarily, hoping that this for a particular outcome, but engaging in the places that we feel drawn to, and that being a way of embodying hope.
Yeah, kind of I completely agree with that.
Yeah.
Rather than having it become a passive place, and
well,
we can get caught in wishing and thinking it's hope. And I wish things would be different, but that creates a certain passivity. And I think there is, we do need to be actively engaged in it. Mm-hmm. Soul activism is that response that we can make that can generate options, possibilities, mm-hmm. imagination, and above all, little moments of beauty, which we are deeply in need of right now.
Oh, well, we couldn't end on a more beautiful note than that. That was beautiful. Thank you so much, and thank you for kind of wading through there was a little muck there in the beginning that I feel like finally kind of clicked in, and I just appreciate your humanity and being able to be fully human with you and engage this really important topic. So I'm grateful.
Well, yeah, no, it was very... very good to actually even begin that way, because I think that's where a lot of us are.
Mm-hmm.
We're in our grief, we're in our confusion, mm-hmm. we're in our not knowing, and to begin there was actually quite good.
Yeah.
So thank you, Aninia.
Thank you. I'm waiting for it to say it stopped recording.
Okay.